Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. Next up on This Week in Law. My head is spinning a bit because we're going to consider all of the legal ramifications of making Let's Play videos. Not only what happens if you're authorized to use the video, but what happens if one of the celebrities in your game is going to come after you for publicity issues. Oh, my, my, my. We're going to talk about that. Rights of publicity, copyright reform, privacy issues, Congress writing to Google. We've got a wonderful panel for this. Kyle Orland is the senior gaming editor at Ars Technica. Derek Khanna, who's an author at Forbes and elsewhere. Evan Brown and me, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown. Episode 212, recorded May 24th, 2013. Let's play Ad Revenue Away. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymously and without oversight. For 20% off your new account, go to proxpn.com/twit and use the code TWIL. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. I'm really excited about today's panel. We're having a couple of Skype glitches. We have one guest that we're hoping can join us. He's not on with us just yet, but his name is Kyle Orland, and he's the senior gaming editor over at Ars Technica. So with Kyle on the phone and our other guest, Derek Khanna. Hello, Derek.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
It's wonderful to see you again. Derek, of course, is a copyright activist and prolific writer on issues related to copyright reform and legislation. Definite Washington policy wonk. So I'm thinking that if we can get Kyle on, we'll have a show tailor-made for Francis Underwood of House of Cards fame, someone who appreciates both gaming and policy, because we've got lots of stories on deck. There are lots of things going on that intersect with our concerns here about law and technology in both of those worlds. So let's start out on the copyright front. And before we get too far down that road, let me also mention that Evan Brown, my co-host, is here with us today. I forgot to introduce you right at the front there, Evan.
Well, you know, we're just starting our Memorial Day partying a little bit early, so we can just keep it going like this. But it's great to be here. Looking forward to a conversation. Derek, great to have you back. It should be a lot of fun.
Yes, absolutely. So let's talk some copyright reform, Derek, since that is much on your mind at all times, and you have a piece in the Washington Post on their wonk blog, which is new, if I'm not mistaken. Am I right?
It's relatively new. I mean, it's Ezra Klein's section of Washington Post. It's been around for a few years.
Okay, good. Tell us what you've told the wonk blog folks about copyright reform. Certainly it's something that Congress is paying attention to, which is encouraging.
Sure. So the article is called Let Artists, Innovators, and the Public Define Our Copyright System. And basically my argument is, the Registrar of Copyright testified before the Judiciary Committee and said it's time for a new great digital copyright act. And so now we're having a series of hearings in the Judiciary Committee to analyze exactly what that could look like and what substantive reforms could be on the table. And my perspective was that we need to make sure that these deliberations include all involved parties, which is more than just the content creators through their Hollywood lobbyists. It has to be, new content creators as well that are not necessarily represented by RIA in Hollywood. It needs to be innovators and entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, and it has to be the public at large, which is also an affected party. And I pointed out that the RIA and MPAA have a history of favoring laws that are designed to inhibit innovation. So they went after the VCR. The VCR was upheld by one vote. But Jack Valenti called those who use the VCR akin to Jack the Ripper in Boston. then they went after the digital audio tape, sorry, the digital tape deck, and they ensured that the digital tape deck never entered the U.S. market, but it was a success in other markets around the world. And then they went after the first iPod, the Rio. They went after the first DVR, Ultimate Replay TV. And in those cases, the technologies were ultimately found to be lawful, but they spent so much money on litigation that they actually ran out of went into bankruptcy, had to sell the trademark effectively. And so we need to make sure we have laws that more clearly define what technologies are lawful, so that way you don't have this dead weight loss in the economy and you don't have potentially bad actors trying to go after new innovations.
So one thing that that came to mind when I read your piece was in prepping for the show today, we're going to talk in a little while about Let's Play videos, which are videos that show people playing games as they go along and do it, becoming very popular on YouTube and elsewhere. In 2009, Cory Doctorow had a great piece in The Guardian entitled, let me get the exact caption here, "When Love is Harder to Show Than Hate." And it's about fan fiction in particular and fans in general and people who are passionate about a creative work and whether they are creating their own derivative works spun off of it. Cory leads this 2009 piece with a bunch of folks in Second Life, if you guys remember that, who created a whole virtual world of Dune within Second Life, but had to stop doing so in response to complaints by the Frank Herbert estate. And his point in this article is that copyright law is not designed to allow works that flatter and spread the word about how great something is to thrive as much as it is to set up, allow for criticism and parody. Do you think that this is something, this seems a bit of a subtle point to expect Congress to tackle as it prepares to address copyright reform, Derek? Or do you think that in paying attention to creators and innovators, they may just get there?
I think it's a really important issue. So in the report that I wrote for the House Republican Study Committee, I talked about abuse of copyright law and how copyright can sometimes lead to censorship, where you allow for reproduction for certain purposes but not for other purposes. Jason Mazzone has his book, Copy Fraud, talks a lot about this phenomenon of copyright being used to drown out criticism and kind of shape the debate, which is not really its intended purpose. And Mazzone even talks about, for works that are actually in the public domain, how this could be used as well. So he talks about the estate of a famous author and where the author has letters that effectively expose him as being gay. And the estate did not want those letters to be publicly published because they wanted to, quote unquote, protect his image. And so as a result, they were able to keep these letters from ever being made public, even though they were already in the public domain and they should have been reproducible at will. So copyright is a tool that can be used for these additional purposes when the real purpose originally, of course, was to compensate the owner. And you have to be very careful that people aren't claiming copyright to ensure that leaked documents aren't reproduced, which is not really the intended purpose.
Let's go ahead and welcome Kyle Orland, who we've managed to get on the phone. Hello, Kyle.
Hi there. Technology, ain't it great?
It is. We're so glad that we're all here talking about tech because we rely on it for so many things, including doing shows like this. Hopefully, we can rely on good old-fashioned copper wire telephone technology if that's what you're joining us on today.
That's right. Thanks, Ma Bell.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so we're discussing copyright reform and going to go through a few more copyright-related stories here, Kyle, just to bring you up to speed before we jump into things more in your wheelhouse in the gaming world. But definitely feel free to chime in on what we're discussing here. Derek Khanna, who's on with us too, was also instrumental, lobbied in the old-fashioned sense of the word, was vocal and very erudite on the what became the Unlocking Technology Act and the need to do away with having cell phones locked down. Derek, we haven't had you on the show since this act was actually introduced, so I just wanted to pick your brain about how you feel Congress did in coming up with this proposal.
You know, this is exactly what we were asking for. You know, I work closely with Lufgren's office on this legislation and Massey's office, who also co-sponsored the bill, and Jared Polis. And we were really pleased to see this legislation. And, you know, I had spearheaded this movement with, of course, a variety of other actors. But I think this represents a real consensus view. And, you know, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act was designed to protect content holders and deal with the issues relating to piracy. And so to the extent that the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is being interpreted to ban other technologies, to ban technologies that may help blind or deaf persons, to ban technologies for, you know, jailbreaking or unlocking your phone, it really isn't consistent with the aims of the DMCA. So I think we're going to see a broad tent, you know, coalition emerge around this issue. You know, during our campaign, we had, you know, the Tea Party Nation and National College Republicans endorse it. In the same time when Vint Cerf endorsed it. And now this bill has FreedomWorks that has endorsed it. And we expect a lot of other endorsements on the right. So it really effectively what the legislation does is it says that if the use of a technology does not have an infringing purpose, then that technology should be inherently lawful. So unlocking, jailbreaking, computer science research, accessibility technology for persons who are blind and deaf, all those technologies would presumably be made lawful.
You got right to the part of the proposed bill that actually concerns me, and that is how the difficulty in sussing out intent. You know, when you create a technology, it has various abilities, and you really don't know what users are going to do with it. You know, it may be capable of infringing purposes, but that might not have been the intent. And it seems like the Unlocking Technology Act here focuses more on the intent. And I'm wondering how you think that's going to shake out.
Sure. So it's difficult always to kind of to you know, strike the careful line. But this is actually language that the courts have used previously. They ruled, for example, that garage door openers cannot be held under the DMCA because there's no real nexus there to protected content. So I think that this is definitely going to be an important tool. It's going to be up to the courts and how they interpret this. But if you can demonstrate that the use of the technology just has no implications for piracy, I think this is going to allow for you to get off. I think this is going to be an important thing. So, for example, let's say somebody was arrested for unlocking their phones, or you had a website that got shut down for offering unlocking your phone technology. They could go into court and say unlocking your phone has nothing to do with copyright, and it would be up to the up to Motorola or whomever has brought the suit to show that there's an infringement to copyright at play here. And I think that that's going to be extremely difficult to show, if not impossible.
Evan, anything that you want to hit on this Unlocking Technology Act before we move on?
No. I mean, I think it's I agree with Derek's assertion that it seems to show a pretty broad consensus here. There are plenty of other reasons why one should be concerned about this issue other than just cell phone unlocking. My only concern about this would be if we are going to just, you know, really push on the question of cell phone unlocking, and that's something that, you know, we have this right to do, or if we're going to be so, strong in characterizing it that way, whether or not that will have a negative consumer effect on the availability of smartphones to the consuming public, because the carriers rely on these protections here to subsidize to subsidize the ability to provide smartphones to consumers at a reduced rate. You don't have to go pay full price for the Galaxy S4. You can get it, with the idea from the carrier that's being subsidized, kind of it's akin to financing it over time. So I just, you know, my biggest concern is, will there be some unintended consequences that negatively affect the consumer when it comes to all this, but on balance, hopefully the benefits that we see in other areas and the availability of works for subsequent use and to help the disabled, the blind, the deaf will be put a net positive on developments like this.
Derek, can you specify for us how small business owners would benefit from this?
Sure. So there's many wireless carriers in the market. There are about 100, over 100 wireless carriers in the market. And their main trade association, the Competitive Carriers Association, was strongly in favor of unlocking because it's one technology that will allow for more competition in the market. You can have a new competitor enter the market. So let's talk about one called Republic Wireless. And they have a new market model, which is when you're in a Wi-Fi area, you're on Wi-Fi for calls and everything else. And when you're in a non-Wi-Fi area, you're in Sprint for everything else. And they charge $20 a month, thereby cutting the market, you know, by 60-some percent. And their biggest difficulty is having that relationship with Apple, being able to have the exclusivity with the iPhone or other comparable smartphones. And in a world where you can unlock your phone after your contract has expired, you can bring your phone over to them and say, hey, $20 a month sounds like a pretty good deal to me. And that's one of the biggest things that they're dealing with now is customers saying that they don't want to jump over them because they want to have these premium phones. And Evan and I have sparred on this issue previously, so I don't want to get too in the weeds, and I respect Evan's opinion. But as far as the subsidized model, I feel like that's kind of a non-issue, which is that's protected through contract law. And nothing at issue here would infringe upon those contracts. So if you buy a subsidized phone with your carrier, you're going to have to fulfill that contract. And that's how they're made whole. What we're talking about is if you unlock your phone, that should not be a felony. And so after your contract ends, then that's an easy opportunity for you to take your phone to somebody else. And if you were to unlock your phone while you're under contract, then you have to pay a fine to your, you know, AT&T or Verizon. So they're still going to be making money off of you either way. So there's no real reason why that would ruin the subsidized model. But further, if you actually do the math out, Americans are not getting some sort of a special deal that no other country is getting with their subsidized model. In the end, we're actually paying considerably more money. But if you really want the subsidized model where you pay more money, that's still protected.
Well, leaving it to contract law to provide a remedy to the carriers would do essentially nothing. No reasonable carrier is going to go to small claims court for, you know, this amount of of alleged damages that they would be asserting against somebody who violated the terms of their contract here. You know, if we're going to buy into the subsidized model, probably a bad pun, if we're going to start from the operating point where that could have some consumer benefit, then there's got to be some meaningful mechanism to back that up. Am I saying that somebody should go to jail for unlocking their phone? No, but they should face real liability if we're going to assume that that does have any kind of validity at all. The real point is contract law would have no effect. It would be powerless to enforce the carrier's rights when it comes to all this. I just think that's how it would play out in reality.
I mean,
all right, go ahead, Derek. You want to jump in?
I completely disagree. I mean, contract law is sufficient for car leases or for house mortgages or for every other issue. I mean, do you think that doesn't deal with customers who don't pay their bills? And there's ample ways to deal with this through the contract. You can put it, forced arbitration. You can put it in structured, you don't have to take everything to court if you put it in contract correctly.
It's still not going to be worth the carrier's while to pursue thousands of breach of contract actions. You know, a foreclosure on a $500,000 mortgage, there's a lot more at stake. And so there's more of an incentive for the lender to go after their contract rights in that situation. We're dealing with, compared to the price of a mortgage or the price of a car, these are consumer goods that aren't worth nearly as much. So, it's probably just it comes down to empirical stuff. I'm totally speculating. I have no idea how it would play out in the marketplace. I just know that if I were counseling a carrier, whether to engage on a litigation strategy of going and suing 100,000 people in various small claims courts, or even to arbitration, to take your point out, it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense, and it would essentially render those rights that substantiate the ability to provide these at a lower cost to the consumer. It would do away with that whole mechanism.
Well, I mean, you know, if you buy a cable, if you have Comcast and you rent a cable modem for $5 a month, and then you leave Comcast and, you know, you have this $200 cable box you're supposed to give back, they have remedies to deal with that. So this subsidized model actually permeates throughout the market in a variety of industries, not just the car and mortgage example. And they're able to deal with it through smart contracts. Not through using the DOJ to arrest people, and that's what you want in an economy. Is you want efficient breach. If consumers believe they can get a better deal, you structure the contract in such a way where you pay a very high fine, and that you know AT&T and Verizon are made whole off of their investment. But you want the customer to be able to go to somebody else that's able to compete in the market.
Denise, I'll leave it to you to declare the horse dead.
I think this horse is dead, but thanks you guys. Good thoughts on both sides of that issue. And it actually segues well into something else I wanted to talk about today. And that is the dismissal of this case in Medford, Oregon. Have any of you ever been to Medford? I've been to Medford. It's a tiny little place. Beautiful place up near the Rogue River. And up there, a federal judge decided that Voltage Pictures, which was suing over the alleged torrenting of the 2012 Steven Seagal and Steve Austin film, and I use that term loosely, Maximum Conviction, that they tossed this case out. Some defendants lived in Medford, and that's why it was up there in federal court. Judge Ann Aiken said the company had unfairly lumped the plaintiffs together to save more than $200,000 in court costs. And possibly to intimidate them into paying $7,500 a piece in settlement. They had sent the typical settlement-oriented shakedown letter saying $7,500 would save the potential defendants the risk of facing $150,000 damages without prompt payment. So the judge just had none of this, just said, sorry, no, these 34 Oregonians that you have sued, she called it a reverse class action and, isn't going to let that happen. So I guess the upshot here is they can all be sued individually, but, the court didn't like the way the plaintiff Voltage Pictures here went about this procedurally and went out of her way to voice some concerns about these kinds of cases and the fact that when you're talking about something here, she cited some stats that a Blu-ray DVD combo of the movie can be obtained for just $9 at Amazon and a digital rental is just $3.99. That trying to get $7,500 out of people in settlement for having downloaded that movie struck her as not something that the court system is designed for. Now, I don't know that she would fare very well on appeal on that kind of sentiment, but it's interesting to see that kind of perspective being taken by a federal court judge, don't you think, Evan?
For sure. And I think at the end of the day, justice is done in, you know, the decision that she made like that. But it really does seem like she just sort of ignored the Copyright Act and made this very much of a common sense argument equating the reasonability of statutory damages to actual damages that really is not relevant. I mean, you know, plaintiffs always like to say it's not relevant. Defendants always try to make it relevant, this any connection between actual harm suffered and what one would be able to recover under statutory damages concern. And so, I mean, we're seeing the same thing kind of under different guises in some of the porn BitTorrent copyright troll cases, Prendelaw et al.
Right.
You know, with courts saying that this joinder is improper here. And I think that's the sentiment where what this judge is characterizing as a reverse class action. It's the disdain for that that's coming through here. That's just kind of like not right to do it this way.
We should explain to people that the reason why a plaintiff would decide to lump in a bunch of defendants in one lawsuit is when you go to court and file, you pay one filing fee as opposed to 34 in this case. So it's a cost-saving measure. And as she points out, it also, you know, if you can lump everybody together, I suppose that gets them all talking and has some sort of ability to create a stir that would not otherwise be there with individual lawsuits, perhaps. So interesting dismissal there. And speaking of class actions, in the ongoing saga of Viacom versus YouTube, the trial court judge, Lewis Stanton, who has twice shut out Viacom on its claims, has now shut them out on bringing the suit as a class action for all similarly situated folks. So another interesting procedural development here. It does not seem like Viacom is going to have an easy time of this as it comes around the second time in the trial court, does it, Evan?
No. I mean, it's good. You know, we get these, you know, more and more. We learn more and more about the contours of Section 512, but mm-hmm. and you know, the further we get from those early days of YouTube, 2004, 2005, the right. less relevant these facts really come. So it exponentially becomes a kind of a more stark question: what is the real economic incentive for continuing to fight this battle here?
Right. And then before we leave our copyright topics, I wanted to plug once again, as we did last week when we had Larry Downs on the show, Hacking Politics, the on-demand pay your own price ebook that lots of great people have contributed to, including Derek. Derek, what did you write about in this book from Demand Progress?
Sure. So I wrote about, you know, my experience of working on Capitol Hill and, you know, working there for, at the time I was working for Senator Scott Brown, who came out against SOPA PIPA, and that was an issue that I worked on for him at the time, and I thought it was an interesting perspective to be able to provide, you know, one view of somebody within the system who experienced a deluge of about 3 million people reaching out to their member of Congress. And then I talked about writing the copyright memo and briefly touched about, you know, then launching the phone unlocking campaign. So kind of a full circle on all those issues and trying to provide a different perspective to the majority of people who are contributing on having worked on the outside.
Yes, my consumption of this book has been an exercise in the benefits of interoperability as I attempt to get it to load on my iPad or my Kindle so I can read it. So I'm still working on that, Derek. I hope to read you soon. Let's move on from talking about copyright in the abstract to a little bit more concrete stuff with a new gaming device that was introduced this week. And let's talk about entertainment. All right, Kyle, you've just come off 9 days of travel, including attending and live blogging prolifically and then writing furiously afterwards about the Xbox One launch. This is supposed to be the ultimate all-in-one home entertainment system, going to change everything about how we do TV and gaming. Do you think it's going to live up to the hype?
I don't know. The reaction so far has been rather muted from the gaming community, I would say, and that's probably because Microsoft spent a lot of time focusing not on gaming but on general entertainment features. In the hour long presentation, about, I'd say, 20 minutes was devoted to showing how you could play TV and movies and get Skype calls on your TV at the same time and switch, you know, between a game of Forza and The Price is Right almost instantly without having to use a remote control, which did not really excite many people. You can already do that with just the input-output button on your TV, right? They spent 5 or 10 minutes talking about a Halo TV show with Steven Spielberg. They spent more time talking about a partnership with the NFL that is going to revolutionize the way the game is played in some amorphous way they didn't really discuss. And then there was precious little about the actual games that are going to be on the system besides, you know, another Call of Duty and some very odd hybrid of a TV show and a game experience, which was not really explained at all. So it was an odd debut for their core audience, but I think it's part of a 1-2 punch. In 3 weeks or so, E3 is going to happen, and that's when I think they're really going to unload the barrage of games, and people are going to start to forget about this and really focus on, you know, what they can play on the system.
Right. The claims being made here remind me of the hype around Google's set-top box. What is that thing called again? I've completely blanked on it.
Google
we don't
TV?
Own one. Google TV.
Google TV, yes.
That's a good name for it.
Yeah, which sort of fell prey to the fact that it's difficult to get licensing for everything they wanted to do. Do you see Microsoft in that same boat?
Well, the big thing they're going with here, already on the Xbox 360, they have a bunch of IPTV channels. You can get Sci-Fi Network and HBO Go and things like that. What this is doing is it has an HDMI input so that you can actually get your cable or TV shows straight through the Xbox. Now, what that provides you with is the ability to control it with Kinect voice commands and quickly switch between it and, you know, multitask with things like snapping web browsers or Skype on the sidebar. What it can't do, interestingly to me, it seems, is act as a DVR, which you think would be the killer app. You have a 500 gigabyte hard drive on this thing. You're already using it to play games. Why not let it be a DVR, too? From what I've been hearing, and Microsoft isn't confirming this one way or another, but they're saying that they really don't want to piss off their entertainment partners by turning the Xbox One into a TiVo as well. So while you can do DVR functions for gameplay, you can take a clip of Halo 5 and share it very easily. If you're watching, say, Game of Thrones, you can't record that even to watch for later use through the Xbox One. So this gets into a bit of a legal area where I'm not really sure if it's legal or if it's just a business thing. But it really doesn't make much sense to me that, you know, what would really be the killer app to get people to hook this up to their TVs and to really get excited about buying it, they're apparently not doing.
Well, it just uses itself as an interface for the cable box. Is that what I'm getting from you then? It accesses the cable box.
Yeah. It plugs into the cable box. The cable box out would go into the Xbox in, and then mm-hmm. you would change your TV to be through the Xbox. And then
right.
the Xbox could control the cable box either through that HDMI or through an IR blaster, which means you could just say, connect, play HBO, and it switches to HBO in, you know, less than a second.
So couldn't you also say, connect, play Game of Thrones recorded last Sunday?
Well, that's the thing. From everything I've heard, the system just does not have the ability to record TV shows. Microsoft is not building that in.
But if the cable box does, could it access, you know, the huge DVR on the cable box?
If the cable box already has a DVR, it's unclear. They did not talk about that. I suppose you have to integrate with a lot of different DVR systems there. So all they really showed was changing channels mm-hmm. and bringing up a very simplified program guide. So features deeper than that, it's unclear.
Yeah. Interesting. What do you think, Evan? Are you going to get one of these things?
You know, I'll wait a while. It won't be, you know, waiting in line right before the holidays to get one of the things. But it looks intriguing. I'm wondering how hard it would be to modify it, you know, to be as a DVR. I mean, yeah, granted, I know mm-hmm. at this point it's so abstract we wouldn't know, but there has to be some ability to hack that thing to be able to serve as a DVR. And you know, maybe there will be some legislation on the books that will make that circumvention of whatever is keeping you from doing that not to be unlawful, you know, by that time.
Yeah, maybe. Derek, how do you think that would play out under the Unlocking Technology Act?
I mean, so we actually see this a lot, which is that video game manufacturers really try to lock down their consoles. And there's a whole, you know, group of people that are trying to alter their consoles. And I think it was the Wii that chose not to pay the licensing fee for the DVD. I think I'm correct on these details. They chose not to pay the licensing fee for the DVD, which is why you can never play DVD movies on Nintendo's Wii. But of course, okay. consumers found a way to hack the system to allow for you to do DVDs. So there's a long history of this. It's kind of unclear where that would end up in the Lofgren bill, because you can also imagine that these technologies do have a potentially infringing purpose, which is that if you're altering the system in these ways, those alterations could allow for you to play unauthorized games in the systems too, which is the primary purpose behind locking these systems down in a pretty effective way, which is to say that there is rampant IP theft for music and for movies and even for books to some extent. But at least – and there's also for PC gaming pretty extensive IP theft. But in the video game sector – it's much reduced because it's very technologically difficult.
Isn't that a huge irony? Irony is the right word, that, you know, the reason that you would want to do this is to have it serve as a DVR, which I don't know if anybody would dispute me in saying that under the 1984 Sony case, you know, the Betamax case, that would be a perfectly lawful, fair use. So I recognize that that's not really the issue that we're looking at, whether or not the circumvention should be lawful, not what you're talking about, Derek. But isn't that ironic that there would be, that may not even come within the contours of that bill, when all a truly innocent person would want to do is record Price is Right, to stay with Kyle's example.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that I was surprised about, I thought that a real potentially killer app is if Microsoft were to do something more analogous to Aereo, which is to say, you know, if you have Comcast and you already have these channels, we're going to let you DVR it online on our servers. And we're going to offer, like, you know, something absurd, like a terabyte of data for you to record your own TV shows. And you can record as many TV shows as you want, as long as you have those channels you're lawfully paying for. You know, I think there's some logistical issues there, but I have been thinking about that for a while as kind of a killer app for somebody like Xbox to pull off. It's going to be interesting.
What they already are doing kind of along that way, it's not really like Aereo, but they're offering the ability to get on-demand things from Verizon or Comcast, I believe, and also streaming from HBO Go. So it's not quite being able to record your own content, but you can get the content from them. The thing is, the content providers are still in charge there. They're the ones who are deciding what to offer on demand. You can't just use the device to record whatever you want over the air.
Right, so it's moving toward more of an a la carte approach, to the extent that something like HBO Go, or I forget what the Cinemax one is, but a bunch of the cable channels have their own apps where you can access and view things on demand.
Again, Microsoft is making such a big push for live TV that you can watch live sports and such through your Xbox, and they didn't really offer a compelling reason why you would want to do that through your Xbox, except for, you know, Kinect controls and multitasking. That really doesn't seem so appealing to me as a consumer personally. I think a DVR would be an obvious thing to do, except that if they did that, they would lose a lot of relationships they already have with, you know, big conglomerates like NBC and HBO and all of those. I think there's a real business case that's stopping them from unlocking the full potential of this device.
So it seems like, in addition to entertainment, that communications was a big push for this launch event that you attended. They talked a lot about Skype and how good the Kinect is and how you could do a video conference call type environment that is better than other things that are out there.
Yeah, it has the new Kinect, which is coming with every Xbox and actually has to be hooked up to the system at all times. Has a 1080p video camera, so they're hoping that this finally unlocks the video phone that we've been all wanting in our living rooms, or at least that's been the dream of a lot of technologists, that you know, you could actually do video calls with everyone, and without having to sit in front of your laptop or your computer, you're just playing something or watching TV, and a call comes in, and you can put that in a little snap window on the side. You're still watching TV. And, you know, you can trash talk during the football game was one example that they gave, or talk with your family while Star Trek is playing on the other window, because, multitasking is all the rage these days, I guess. But yeah, communications was also a big focus of this instead of games.
So is anybody concerned on the show here today as Microsoft makes this push not to just be the gaming guru on the Xbox, but also wants to be in charge of communications and the web and your online viewing, that they're going to become an entity much like Google that knows a whole lot about you, maybe some things about you that Google doesn't even know. I noticed over on your site, actually, I think it was Evan who noticed this, Kyle, that Dan Gooden wrote about Skype not having end-to-end encryption. I'm sure that didn't come up at the launch.
No, they definitely did not talk about that. But what I've been hearing from a lot of my readers, more than just encrypting their data, is whether or not the privacy of having the Kinect in your living room is really worth it. So the real concern is that the Xbox is always on to an extent. If you don't unplug it, it goes into a low power state where it listens for your voice commands. Like if you say Xbox on, it has to be listening for that. And also the Kinect has to be hooked up at all times for the system to function. So you could unplug them both when you turn it off. But for most people, you turn off the system and technically the Kinect could still be watching and listening to you. Now, this, a lot of people are paranoid that this means that Microsoft, you know, could be watching you even in the dark. It has an IR sensor that could capture you without any light. So, you know, this could be, if you get into real tinfoil hat territory, this could be a nationwide spy network controlled by Microsoft. Of course, Microsoft pushes back very hard against this. We have privacy laws, but, you know, there's always the potential of hacking. Someone could get into your system and see you. And there's also the potential for marketers. You don't know what information Microsoft is going to be sharing with its partners. In fact, there was a patent that came out last year that Microsoft put out that actually discussed tracking the number of people who are in a room and watching the screen through something like Kinect. And in that way, say, a movie provider could charge a different fee for six people to watch a movie rather than two people. It's there's a lot of issues out there about this. I'm not sure they would ever implement this, but the fact that they patented it at all is a little creepy.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Derek, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, there are a bunch of thoughts there. I'm interested in the privacy aspects of, you know, the government, if they wanted to get a subpoena and kind of watch your living room at all times. That kind of scares the bejesus out of me.
Oh, man. I didn't even think of that.
But the other side to this, too, is I think that the DVR stuff is being colored by the lawsuit about the AutoHop feature from Ultimate TV, where the AutoHop DVR won the Best of CES award this year by CNET, and then CNET decided that they wanted to revoke it. So they their official announcement they did not win. And that was allegedly an order by their parent company, which I think was NBC?
CBS.
CBS. So that turned into like a big kerfuffle online. And so, you know, it's interesting to see how this all plays out there. But I think it's definitely coloring the discussion.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Aside, they don't want to be Aereo and they don't want to be AutoHop. And I think that those are pretty conscious decisions that seem to have gone into this particular device. Just a non-legal related question for Kyle, since you pay attention to games and consoles. Nintendo's been trying to do something like this too on the Wii U. We have a Wii U and I've never been able to get it to communicate with our cable box. So it's not even, I can't even tell you, you know, if it works, let alone how well it works. Do you get the impression that that is having any impact?
What my Xbox One is doing is a little different from the Nintendo TV feature that you're talking about. Pretty much all that does is let the Wii U gamepad act as a remote control and additional data machine for your TV. So you have to program it like any programmable remote control to work with your cable box, and then you actually switch over to your cable box and just watch TV as normal. You can use the touchscreen as a remote. And then for certain programming, they have special features on the gamepad, so you can follow along with chats or see photos of key moments in a TV show, follow play-by-play through sports. That's only for selected programs. You can also use the gamepad as a programming guide of sorts, and just hit the program and it will automatically change the channel for you. It's a little bit more limited than what Xbox One is doing, which is really trying to integrate it and have the signal go through the Xbox One and mm-hmm. let you control it directly. There was
right.
more, talk about
more like how the TiVo functions, as you mentioned before.
Right, and there's also the ability. They were a little vague about this, but since you're going through the Xbox One, they could have some interactive content for certain things. Like you're watching a live presidential debate, for instance, and it might pop up instant poll questions as you're watching. You know, what do you think of this policy position? And then people vote instantly, and everyone would see the results. They've already tried this a little bit with the Xbox 360 through IPTV. You could stream the debate, and they would ask questions. But this would be, you know, even if you're watching on ABC or NBC, your Xbox One could pop up and, ask millions of people for an instant opinion. So there's some potential to do interesting interactive things with this. The real question is, are people going to adopt it? Are people really going to want to watch TV through their Xbox One rather than just, switching over to the cable box input?
All right. Well, unless, Evan, any final thoughts on this before we move on?
No, just to touch on that point with the Kinect being a device through which surveillance could happen. I mean, comparisons to Orwell and 1984 are a dime a dozen, but it is particularly, representative of the telescreen, that device, having it there, that kind of two-way interface like that is frightening.
They may just get a stern letter from Congress. They may. before we'll get to what I'm alluding to there in a minute. But before we do that, I do want to put our first MCLA passphrase into the show, and it's going to relate to our next topic, and that is let's play. So let's play is our first passphrase. If you are listening to this show for continuing education credit in the legal field or another. And I'd like to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law before we go ahead and forge ahead here with Derek Khanna and Kyle Orland and Evan Brown on all the great topics we've got to discuss today. We couldn't be doing that without ProXPN, who is our sponsor today. More than ever, your online freedom and privacy are under threat. Gee, I think that's what we were just talking about. Governments and ISPs want to control what you can and cannot see while keeping a record of everything you do. Plus, that free Wi-Fi at the coffee house, hotel, and airport is putting you at risk because your passwords and sensitive data can be intercepted more easily than you might think. So when you've got an ISP that is using the six strikes system, as many in the U.S. have signed on to, you also have to be concerned about false positives with that system and whether something that you're doing, if you're using a lot of bandwidth, might trigger an alert for your ISP that puts you into the six strike system and may ultimately have you disconnected and possibly subjected to legal action because somebody thinks that you're engaged in copyright infringement. So if you're concerned about any of these issues, I encourage you to check out ProXPN. It's a global VPN, which is a virtual private network that works with almost any internet connection. It creates a secure encrypted tunnel through which all your online data passes back and forth. Any online application that can work with ProXPN, including your web browser, email, file sharing, and instant messaging programs, ProXPN keeps everything you do online hidden from prying eyes, disguising your physical location and giving you unfettered access to any website or online service, no matter where you live or travel to. It has complete online privacy through a 512-bit encryption tunnel. It works via OpenVPN or PPTP. You get to choose which one. You protect yourself against your ISP's six strikes rule, as I mentioned. You bypass internet filtering and blocked websites, bypass geographical restrictions for internet content and online video with worldwide servers in the United States, the UK, Asia, and more. You really have to check this out. Steve Gibson over at our Security Now site has thoroughly kicked the tires on it. Really likes it, thinks it's a great VPN product. Go to proxpn.com/twit for more information and to sign up. ProXPN premium accounts are normally $9.95 a month or $74.95 for an entire year. But we've got a special offer for you. If you use the code TWIL, T-W-I-L, you'll get 20% off the lifetime of your account. That's less than $5 a month on the yearly plan. So if you're not satisfied, you can cancel within 7 days for a full refund. You really have to check it out. ProXPN.com/twit. Sign up with the code TWIL, T-W-I-L. And we thank ProXPN for their support of This Week in Law. Derek, I've got to say, ProXPN seems like one of those products that, you know, it causes me a little concern. It's a copyright neutral technology, but in the Unlocking Technology Act, if we're dealing with intent, I'm wondering if a VPN like this might get swept, you know, under the umbrella of somebody who's encouraging infringement. What do you think about that?
Well, the Unlocking Act is only beneficial in these situations. It says that for purposes of the DMCA, and then it provides an additional protection level. So if this technology is lawful today, it would certainly be lawful under this act. Basically, the courts are of two minds in these type of issues, which is to say they allow for a technology like BitTorrent to exist. The technology itself isn't illegal, but then a website like Napster was found to be illegal, even though the technology itself, you could argue, is kind of content neutral. But because they're able to demonstrate that it was fostering piracy, that it was designed for piracy, all sorts of other things that are brought into court. So it's kind of a fine line the court has walked through a bunch of times, and the rulings don't necessarily make that much sense to combine, but we have a bunch of cases on what is and what is not lawful.
We sure do. All right. I promised we'd talk about Let's Play videos. I think this is fascinating. YouTube has a Google Plus page and a blog for YouTube content creators. And over on its Google Plus page, just this week, I think it was, they posted up a bunch of advice. No, it was May 13th. To their partners who love to post videos relating to games, where you're showing gameplay, which is called in your industry, Kyle, Let's Play videos. This is definitely an area of entertainment that is on fire. The Machinima channel on YouTube is just going gangbusters. People like to watch other people play videos, and I can see why they would. You know, it's like you like to watch people play sports. You can play baseball yourself, or you can watch really, really skilled players play baseball, and there's a different experience in both of those things. So lots of people are doing this, and some of them are getting in trouble under the content ID system and under the copyright laws because some video game manufacturers do not want other people playing through the games, posting them online, and making a bunch of money off of it. Now, in this advice that YouTube is giving YouTube creators, they're telling people to check the publisher's license agreement because some actually allow you to use all video game content for commercial use and state that in the license agreement. That took me by surprise. Kyle, are you aware of a lot of video game manufacturers taking that approach?
I'm not actually aware of the legal requirements that different publishers take on this. I'm assuming there's probably just general language in the end user license agreements on most of these games in the instruction booklet or whatever that probably says we reserve all rights under copyright or whatever. What I'm not sure of is why any company would really want to stop or hinder these types of Let's Play videos in any way. I don't really see these as a replacement for buying the game. If you see a Let's Play video for a game that looks enjoyable, that's some of the best free advertising you can get for that game out there. I don't think there's a lot of people out there saying, oh, I'm really interested in this game, but instead of buying it and playing it, I'm just going to watch someone else play it. It really doesn't work like that. A game is inherently about playing it, and a Let's Play video doesn't really replace that. So for instance, with Nintendo recently trying to get ad space on these Let's Play videos and take away the livelihood of the people making them take away some of the motivation for them to make it by taking the ad revenue for themselves. I just think they're shooting themselves in the foot with this kind of enforcement, even if it is technically, legally, the fact that this infringes on Nintendo's copyrights and, you know, takes too much of their video, which I'm really not sure of. I leave that to legal experts. But just from a practical point of view, I really don't see why you would attack some of these people who are your greatest fans and are promoting your game in a way that in no way hurts sales.
Yeah, going back to Cory Doctorow's 2009 article on why you get in trouble more for loving than hating under the copyright laws. Exactly. And Joe Mullen over on your site, Ars Technica, who's been on our show before, pointed that out in his piece about Nintendo, because I guess Nintendo took the approach of, okay, we're going to allow these Let's Play videos to stay up, but we're going to insist that we have our ads in them. That's right. The payoff, which is, and I love that Joe pulls out, I guess there's a term for people who make Let's Play videos, ELPers, if I'm saying that right.
Yep. Right.
So it seems like, first of all, I was surprised that the YouTube guidelines here that they've posted, or advice, although they hit a bunch of fair use points, they don't actually ever use the term fair use. I think that's probably not all that surprising on reflection. They're trying to write this in plain and not legal language, but they are talking all around the issue of fair use, as you were too, Kyle, and it, yeah. Talking about how much you can use and whether it really replaces somebody who's going to go out and have the experience of the game itself.
I'm no legal expert here, but to me, I would call it transformative work. Definitely, this is not just raw capture of the gameplay. This is people's commentary is running constantly over this gameplay, and that's the whole appeal of the Let's Play movement. There are other videos on YouTube called long plays, usually, that are just unadorned, usually 30 or 60 minute or even more videos of people just playing the game. And for those, I would understand a little bit more that, you know, okay, the video and audio content generated from this game, that's all it is. We control that. We have a right to stop this. For Let's Play, again, there's commentary all over it. That would seem to fall right under fair use. Now, a lot of these are hours and hours at a time, so I don't know where you run into, you know, can you do a commentary for 10 hours and record their content the whole time and say that's okay? I don't know. I'd like to ask you guys, actually, if your legal expertise, what do you think?
Well, I think we're going to have somebody push back on the Nintendo strategy here. Because of the aspects you just mentioned, that it does transform the original work. There's commentary, there's criticism, there's skill involved, there's creativity in putting the video together. And to have the Nintendo ads dropped into the creative work, I suppose they could just, you know, choose some other platform than YouTube. I would expect to see someone push back and possibly sue over it. Evan, what do you think?
Oh, this is such a good example of a fair use situation, mm-hmm. and that's what Kyle is getting at from a very common sense perspective here. Remember, there are those four fair use factors, and you know, one of them is if the use is transformative. I mean, that's kind of the shorthand way of saying that first factor. That's not what the Copyright Act says. But, you know, here the object of this use of the copyrighted work is different than the original use. This is to show the experience in a demonstrative way rather than to participate in it. I think even a more a factor that would weigh even more favorably to fair use is the other thing that Kyle was talking about. This is not going to affect the market. Nobody's going to decide to watch these videos instead of purchasing the game. So it's on those two areas where I would expect most of the discovery, most of the evidence would be amassed in a summary judgment motion, you know, if a plaintiff were to file a declaratory judgment action on this, or if to, you know, to get sued for infringement on something like this, I think it would right away turn into a fair use type of analysis. And interestingly enough, the alleged infringement would be in making a derivative work of this. So it's kind of just interesting from a, I don't even know if it has any practical application at all, but just to think about it, what's happening here is there's actually joint authorship happening here. The users, the participants, and the copyright holders and the elements of the gameplay are coming here together to create a work of joint authorship. So the nature of the infringement here is that. It's not necessarily making copies or distributing it. Maybe it is in the public performance of it or the distribution over YouTube, but what one instance of infringement would be in this creation of a derivative work, which would be a joint work in all this. But that doesn't change the fair use analysis.
I think I'm gonna disagree with you guys a little bit, which is that what you guys are saying is what makes rational sense, is what the law should be, but it doesn't necessarily jive with what the law has been, which is to say that you have many actors in the art market who are able to use these laws to their advantage. For example, Fox sued, was able to, it was 4.5 seconds of The Simpsons was playing in the background of a movie, and they were able to charge $10,000 to license that material. That was almost certainly fair use. And while we haven't had a case on playing video games, so it is a very unique situation. In some ways, the closest thing I can think on point to that would be if you take a song and you remix that song and you use some samples from that original song, playing a video game and talking about a video game is in some ways analogous, loosely, to kind of remixing that original IP, and both of you being the kind of creators of this new intellectual property. And if you look at the cases as far as remixing and fair use for DJs, they're not that encouraging at all. Unfortunately, and they kind of all are all over the map. Now, in this situation, because it doesn't appear that any of the users were generating revenue or a business off of this, that's one more element that's on their side, as opposed to some of the DJ remixing cases where it was for a commercial use.
Well, actually, some of the Let's Play makers were actually making quite a bit of money off of YouTube ads, which is what Nintendo was trying to get in on. They were trying to show their ads instead of the ads that would be going to the creators of the Let's Play video. They claimed they were the creators of the original game, therefore they should get the ad money.
Sorry, I didn't realize that. That's going to be a big factor that could be used against them. But it's really unfortunate that these market participants, you know, they aren't realizing the big opportunity to monetize off of this and, you know, see it as a threat when it really isn't one. And you can see with Gangnam Style, for example, where they took a different approach towards intellectual property, where they wanted it to be available on YouTube and used it as an opportunity to make something like $4 million. So there's really a variety of ways in how you can interact with your intellectual property. And I don't think this is a strong one. I think that fans should react and demand accountability. But we really need more clarification of what is or is not fair use. And there's about four factors the court looks to. But the most important factor, I believe, is the impact upon the market. Is if you actually can show that it may increase your sales, that should kind of be a silver bullet for fair use.
Yep, that has to go in your copyright reform proposals, Derek, for sure.
It's already in there.
All right, good. I just want to make everybody's head hurt as much as mine did when I thought about this. We've talked before on the show about the various lawsuits by athletes who have appeared in games or celebrities that have appeared in games and have not been fully compensated or felt that their likeness was being used without their permission and have raised right of publicity claims. Well, there's one by former Rutgers quarterback Ryan Hart. He sued EA, and he apparently now has won this suit. It went up on appeals to the Third Circuit, and the court there decided that summary judgment in EA's favor wasn't appropriate. That's what had happened at the trial court level. So there's going to be a trial on this issue, which means that even though the character, as I understand it, I haven't looked this too closely, I don't think the character was specifically identified as Reinhardt. It just looked so much like him, was wearing a uniform that would be identified with him and a number, that the logical conclusion is, yes, that's supposed to be Reinhardt in the game. And that's the case, the issue that he's suing over. So the reason my head started hurting considering these Let's Play videos is even assuming you have one of these generous game makers that Google is, and YouTube are alluding to here, that may have a license that allows for commercial use of all video game content. Then if you're the Let's Play maker, you've got to worry about the Reinhardts of the world who may show up in your game as you're making your video and say, hey, no, my right of publicity is still out there and hasn't been addressed here. So what do you think of that, Kyle?
Oh, gee, I hadn't really even considered that second level legal threat that of broadcasting someone else. I would hope that if the game maker has the rights to put the player in the game, that then the video maker would also have the right to show that player in the game. But of course, that first part is up in the air right now in the court.
That's the big if.
It is really interesting. When you think about a lot of other works of art, say if I wanted to write a book, a work of fiction, or fan fiction even, and you know, I said Tim Tebow threw a pass, I don't think Tim Tebow could go to the book publisher and say, hey, I'm Tim Tebow. That's obviously, you're identifying that as me. You cannot write about me in that way because he's a public figure. It's a work of fiction. It's obviously, you're allowed to do that in your free speech rights. It's interesting that as you get into interactive games, as you get closer and closer to actually simulating that person, that the rights to publicity, the rights to your own name and image, get more and more stringent, so that, as you said, even though it's not actually him, it's close enough to him in statistics, in build, in team he plays for, and stuff that he's wearing, that the courts obviously are deciding that it's a bit much. Whereas, you know, if this were a text adventure game and it was all, and it said, throw a pass, and then it said Tim Tebow threw a pass, I don't really think that would pass any muster. So I think there's probably some legal aspect to that. The level of simulation affects what you can do with the person's likeness.
Right. Well, this case will go back down, and we'll get more findings from the trial court on it, and presumably a trial, since summary judgment was what got tossed out below. So maybe we'll get some more light shed on those issues that you raise and what exactly qualifies as using someone's name and likeness or likeness in this kind of situation. Evan, any thoughts on this?
No, I mean, it is a complex situation, and I hadn't thought of that second layer of complexity that you were talking about either. But it seems like, given that uncertainty, and that second layer of complexity being, you know, the implications for the Let's Play context, and that complexity would seem to affect the game makers more than the individual users, because that's going to be the target of right of publicity lawsuits. It's just, I think I've already articulated this principle in a different context. It's not going to be economically feasible or worthwhile to go after a bunch of individual users for the misappropriation of these rights. It's going to be where the money is and where the centralized control over this can and should be and is.
Well, the second point that YouTube gives people in their guidelines for creators here, first they talk about these generous video game manufacturers who may already have granted you this license. Then they suggest, okay, well, if there isn't a license, go get written permission. And that strikes me as pretty difficult and easier for someone like Machinima, if they can go in and show, look, we've got these bazillions of views and we'll do some sort of sharing and a win-win for everybody. Much easier for that sort of outfit than the very passionate individual gamer who just happens to be really good at these Let's Play videos. Do you know anything about Machinima's partnerships, Kyle, in that way?
No, I don't. I think they've been operating under the same fair use guidelines as everyone else. Mm-hmm. They have obviously some ad relationships to show certain content, but I don't think the things they just, you know, if they're filming a scene they made in The Sims and talking over it, I don't think they get written permission from EA to do that. You'd have to ask Machinima themselves, I guess. What's interesting to me about this, though, is both the PlayStation 4 and the Xbox One are really hyping up features letting you record and share your own gameplay directly. Instead of these Let's Play videos, usually they have to hook up their system to an outside video capture card and then talk over it. They have to do a lot of work through the computer to actually get it up on YouTube. With the new systems, it's going to be very easy to, if you make a cool play or see a cool explosion, you go into the sharing menu, you say, take that last 30 seconds of gameplay that it's constantly recording, that was really cool, and post it on Facebook, post it on YouTube, post it on Twitter. Now, what this does is put the content maker directly in control of this. You're posting it through them, and I'm guessing, this has not been confirmed or anything, but they could control that a bit, monetize it, or at least show that people are sharing it through their system and see that as a promotion. Implicitly, it seems like the console makers are encouraging this type of thing, and I haven't heard any publishers really speaking up and saying, hey, no, please don't share our videos. They see it as viral marketing. I really don't see what the difference is here with what's going to be the new standard and what's currently Let's Play videos.
Yeah, that's a really interesting twist, too. Hey, guys, Evan has a work conflict that he needs to go deal with, so we're going to let him go and wrap the show with just Kyle and Derek and I. Evan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, it's been great. Happy Memorial Day to you. Hope you have a great weekend. And I'm just thinking here, I think the last time I had to leave the show early, that's when Derek was on the last time. So it's really not it's a correlation without causation. It's nothing about
Evan.
That. It's all good. It's all good. So.
Great. Well, we will see you next week and have a great Memorial Day weekend.
Right on. Same to you.
All right. Let's see. There are a couple of other stories I want to hit before we wrap here. And since one of them is going to involve John McCain, let's make him our second MCLA passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law, John McCain. And of course, with him, we're talking about something in the arena of law and policy. So John McCain has a bill pending that is called the McCain Cable Bill or the Television Consumer Freedom Act. And he's all about unbundling. And I'm wondering, Derek, I won't pretend to understand it very well or, you know, what is going to actually be accomplished if this passes. But I'm wondering if it impacts anything that we were discussing earlier regarding unbundled programming on unconventional consumption devices like an Xbox or a Roku. Or is this just simply going after the cable companies and saying you cannot tie up certain channels together and make consumers take that package or not get one of those channels at all?
Yeah, it seems like an all or nothing proposition for the major cable carriers. It doesn't seem like it would necessarily impact Xbox directly. However, if you were to facilitate more of an a la carte like model, that would seem like that's more uniquely in line with Xbox and probably Sony's interest if they go down this route too. So it may make it easier for them to enter the market potentially through a la carte.
Can you tell us briefly what the bill is about and your opinion of it?
Sure. So I'm actually not 100% familiar with some of the intricacies here, but basically it's trying to foster a a la carte market by creating incentives and requirements for the cable providers to unbundle their cable channels. I expect it to have some significant opposition from the cable channels, but also some opposition perhaps from libertarian and conservative groups. I think that there's some issues here that will need to be worked out. And it was interesting to see this bill come out. A lot of people have talked about a la carte pricing for a long time, But there are a lot of consequences of a la carte pricing that many people aren't necessarily aware of. So people actually like the options that they're afforded. And if they had to pay per channel, that may mean that you only have 10 channels or so, and then the cost per channel may go up quite significantly. So, that's basically the legislation at hand. It's going to be interesting to see how it kind of shapes up and what type of opposition is going to gen up.
Kyle, it certainly seems – go ahead. I was going to say it seems like a very consumer-driven kind of piece of legislation, and that on-demand is really where consumers want things to go.
Yeah, personally, if I could only get 10 channels on my cable system and instead of paying whatever it is, $70 a month, I was only paying $40 or $50, I could do without the other 200 channels that I never watch, and I will take the $20 in savings personally. You know, I'm pulling these numbers out of the air, but I'm guessing that the relatively few cable channels I want would cost less than even the smallest cable subscription that I could get today. That would be the hope, at least, if this bill went through. Maybe the stations that I really want are the real expensive ones. I've heard that under this, something like ESPN would cost alone $30 or $40 because that's what it tends to bring in for the cable providers through a variety of means. So who knows how it would actually shake out there. I'd like to see, at least.
Right. Well, we were talking earlier about an as yet unreleased products that just people like Kyle have gotten to kick the tires on. Google Glass is the same kind of thing, but like the Xbox and the considerations that we were raising earlier about having the screen in your living room recording you without your permission, folks obviously have been very concerned and vocal about Google Glass as well, so much so that now the Congressional Bipartisan Privacy Caucus has written a several-point letter to Larry Page. Reading through it, I think a lot of people have had fun making fun of the congressman for being alarmist and not knowing, very basic things about how Glass is expected to work. But as I read through this, I'm actually pretty impressed with their grasp on things and the pointed questions that they're asking. And I certainly hope that Google does give them a response. Do you agree, Derek?
Absolutely. I think these are legitimate questions to bring up. But it is unclear how Google Glass is kind of a privacy game changer, which is to say that most of the things you can do with Google Glass, you could basically have done with your phone for a while. But I think the ubiquity of the Google Glass and the ability to record at all times is kind of a scary proposition for privacy people. Particularly when storage space is continuing to decline. So, you may see a world where you 5, 10, 15 years from now, where everything that ever happens is recorded at all times. And then that content could be publicly streamed to the public. And then you could also couple that with searching by faces. So you could find, any time that you've been in the public and somebody caught you on Google Glass. And that type of the combination of all those tools together, that kind of presents a new threshold for privacy issues.
Yes, and facial recognition is one of the points that is raised here and asking for clarification from Google on whether something's going to be built in or whether third-party applications can work with Glass to do facial recognition. Evan was just telling me before the show, I forget the name of the company he mentioned, that someone is already working on doing that. So they are timely questions. I loved to see the notion of privacy by design in here and asking Google about the role of that in the devices design and thinking about its various points. Kyle, do you have any thoughts on this?
It's interesting to me what Derek said, that it's not really that different from what you could do with other devices already. I think what gets people up in arms is the idea that you could be recorded without being noticed. If someone's taking a video of you with their phone, they're holding the phone out there. If you looked in that direction, you would presumably see that, the phone was up, they were holding their hand awkwardly. And then at least that gives you knowledge of it. Whereas if you're wearing Google Glass all the time, you're not necessarily going to notice it. I don't know if that's a real legal difference or it's just a social difference. I don't really know if it's even a practical difference. You look at the Mitt Romney video that was recorded with a cell phone by that waiter. He just propped it on two glasses, and he never knew he was being recorded. You know, Google Glass doesn't make that any easier. He didn't have to be wearing anything on his head. He just had to put the phone down on the table. So right. I think this is kind of the world we live in now. Whatever you do about Google Glass, it's not going to stop people from, you know, in 10 years, we'll have a camera that's the size of a contact lens, and you could be wearing it without anyone noticing. And then you're anytime you're in public, you're probably being recorded without you knowing it. It's a brave new world out there.
It is. And that's an excellent point. Hey, let us move on to our resource and tip of the week and begin to close out the show. One of the things we've been discussing on the show over the last 2 or 3 weeks is keyword advertising and people upset about their trademarks being used in keyword advertising on Google and presumably elsewhere. Eric Goldman has written an incredibly concise article that is our tip of the week here. That's summed up in the headline, suing over keyword advertising is a bad business decision for trademark owners. And I will let you go to delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/212 to read this through in its entirety, as well as all of the other stories that we've referred to today. If you want to look at any of them in more depth, they are there. But what Eric does is run down recent cases on keyword advertising and show how the plaintiffs in these cases are getting shut out time and again. And even after he published this particular piece, there was another seminal decision in a home decor center case against Google over its keyword advertising, where Home Decor Center not only lost its case, but basically lost its trademark because the court found Home Decor Center to be generic. So in suing, not only was it a bad business decision as far as getting a win on keyword advertising, but they have definite other trademark issues now. So check those out if you're in that boat and are concerned about keyword ads and trademarks. And then our resource of the week is a pretty fun one. It is something that is a socially oriented game, a game that is designed to have you pay attention to socially important issues. It's called Data Dealer. And from the coverage I've read about it, it was funded by the Viennese and Austrian governments. And it's a Facebook game, and it's hysterical. There's also a sample of it. If you go to datadealer.com, you can play through a bit of it online without being in Facebook. And it puts you in the position of gathering data about your various Facebook friends and then leveraging it and selling it. So you're supposed to be, you know, figuring out if you know when somebody's first intimate encounter was, and do you know all their birthdays and various data that you could get from your friends from on Facebook. And then you start working with people like insurance companies who might be interested in the data that you have and selling it and becoming a data mogul. So their tagline is legal, illegal, whatever. And it's a pretty funny game to check out. I thought that would be a good resource of the week given our gaming and policy bent for this week. Had you checked this one out, Kyle?
I've heard about it, but no, I haven't had a chance to check it out while I've been traveling. It sounds like a good way to really highlight those issues in an interactive way. You know, just you can watch a video about this stuff and it would just drone on and on. But if you're actually spying on your own friends, you really get a real internal feel to how much data is out there and what the implications of it are.
There is a festival called the Games for Change Festival. In June, they will be announcing their Games for Change Awards, and Data Dealer is one of the nominees for Most Significant Impact. because it makes you play through collecting, collating, and selling personal data and considering the ethical ramifications of doing that. So it's kind of funny and cool. All right, guys, this has been a really fun show. I greatly appreciate your taking the time to talk through all these issues with us on the Friday of Memorial Day weekend. Derek, always a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks for having me on.
What are you going to be working on in the next few weeks that we should pay attention to?
I got more articles on copyright reform coming out and, about some of the support for this unlocking bill. And I'm helping out a bunch of startups deal with some of their legal issues. And so stay tuned. It's going to be a wild ride with these copyright hearings.
It will. And we're glad you're there writing and thinking and helping the folks in Washington understand these important issues. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Kyle, it's great to have you on the show. It was fun discussing things with you for your Ars Technica piece on, what was that game called now? It's slipping my mind.
It was Game Studio.
Tycoon. Game Dev Tycoon.
Game Dev Tycoon, right.
Yes, which looks really like a fun thing and did its fun twist on copyright by having an alternate version for players who torrented the game, wherein they were going to have to deal with piracy ramifications
A lot of people seem to not get the joke, is the real thing that got me. They went on forums and said, hey, why isn't this game working anymore? I can't win anymore because people keep pirating the game. And I'm just, putting my head against my desk, be like, are you really that dense? You can't figure out what happened.
It was very clever of them. We really appreciate your coming on and telling us about the Xbox. What other interesting things are coming down the pipe on the gaming front?
Next few weeks are going to be all about the run-up to E3. There's a lot of games that I've gotten an early preview of that I'll be posting as soon as I can, as soon as the publishers let me, actually. And then... At E3 itself, Sony and Nintendo and Microsoft, as well as all the publishers, are going to be releasing a lot of data. We're going to get a lot of... We haven't heard yet. They're going to finish them up, finish up all their announcements, and we'll finally have a good idea of what's going to be coming this holiday season.
Great. Well, we look forward to that. And kudos again on your live blogging of the Xbox event. That is not an easy thing to do, and you did a great job.
It was fun. I was honored to be there. You know, they don't let press onto the Xbox campus very often, but it was a real, not life-changing experience, but a real interesting experience.
Good. Glad to hear it. All right, guys, if you would like to join us whenever we record this show, then you should put Fridays at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC on your calendars. That's when we record the show live. And we go about an hour and a half usually. If you can't join us then, you can find the show on, you can find it very easily on our website. That's twit.tv/twill, and the whole archive of shows are there. If you're looking to watch it on a big screen, you can seek us out on Roku or YouTube. We're there with all the shows as well. We're This Week in Law on YouTube. We also have some social media pages where we'd enjoy hearing from you because that's how we develop the topics and hear about suggested panelists. If you head on over to Google Plus, we've got a page there and a Facebook page as well. Evan is Internet Cases on Twitter, and I am D Howell over there. And a lot of people hit us up there too with great ideas. Or you could email us. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Evan is Evan at twit.tv. And I've really enjoyed this show about gaming and policy, and Kyle and Derek, who made it possible for us. And we'll continue to pay attention to these issues and keep you informed. Thanks so much for joining us. Take care.